Welcome to the Friday, November 16th edition of the Clemson Dubcast. Blue skies for the first time in seemingly forever. Goodness gracious, all that rain. I think this is the first clear Friday in weeks. It seems like every Friday that you can remember, it's been pouring with rain. So much welcome to changing the weather. Senior night coming up Saturday against Duke. And you know what the cool thing is? It just dawned on me yesterday, Thursday, and writing about it later today in the final thoughts column, is you got three opportunities to sort of give these seniors a send-off, which is really cool and extraordinary. I mean, think about it. Not a whole lot of suspense on the official senior night against Duke. Not going to be a lot of suspense in the final regular season game against South Carolina. And then in Charlotte against whoever, Pittsburgh, I don't know. Basically, another home game. So three straight home games, essentially, to say farewell to Christian Wilkins and Cleveland Farrell, Hunter Renfrow, a bunch of other really important guys. At TigerIllustrated.com, we ranked Hunter Renfrow's top six plays of his career. Not catches, but plays, and not five, but six, because we had to include a walk-on, number six. So definitely check out that video analysis feature that's on the website right now if you already haven't. Title sponsor of the Clemson Dubcast, Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in Greenville. Very happy to have them aboard. Couldn't do it without them. Blake Smith and Brooke Archenhold, both Clemson grads, both huge fans. Forte of their firm is medical negligence. They represent patients and their family members in medical negligence actions. They also handle all sorts of other complex personal injury litigation. I can vouch for them. About 10 years ago, a family member had a pretty serious medical situation with one of the local hospitals. Went to Blake Smith, and he very quickly and authoritatively gave us some great advice, and we were very thankful for that. Parham Smith and Archenhold offers free consultations. Give them a call, 864-990-4581, or parhamlaw.com. Also sponsoring the Dubcast is the Abernathy Boutique Hotel. Next Friday, Black Friday, folks, the day before the South Carolina game, they're going to host the National Championship Trophy. So from 3:45 to 5:30 p.m., the 2016 National Championship Trophy will be there on display. From 5 o'clock to 8 p.m., live music with Brad Crow and his little lounge act called All of Us. Also from 4:30 to 7, food and drink specials at Taps Bar and Cafe. And from 5 to 7, a tequila tasting sponsored by Herradura. So come on by next Friday. I'll be there banging on some percussion stuff with Brad Crow, great musician. Open to the public. Check him out online at theabernathy.com. Okay, let's get to our guest, Ron Morris. Great friend, great mentor. A lot of great stories from his time as a sports columnist. Also, some insight he wants to share into his very difficult personal struggle with addiction. So here we go. Okay, here with Ron Morris, the former distinguished longtime columnist in the state of South Carolina, also North Carolina, still a writer, I believe, doing freelance stuff, correct?
That's correct, yeah. I had a few things for the Raleigh News and Observer, Baseball America, Basketball Times, just to keep busy.
And I spoke with you a few days ago. I guess as we record this, on a Thursday before the Duke game, you were hard at work on a feature on Dexter Lawrence for the Raleigh paper?
That's correct, yeah. As everybody knows, Dexter's from the Raleigh area, from Wake Forest, and the people at Clemson were kind enough to line up a phone interview with Dexter, got to talk to his mother and his high school coach, and found out some fascinating things, the most interesting of which was that his football career almost never got off the ground. He was he was more interested in basketball. And by his freshman year of high school, he missed the first month of practices for football. And the high school coach, Reggie Lucas, had to go to his mother's home and to Dexter's home and basically convince him that football might be his future. And he did. And the rest, of course, you know, the rest of the story.
Wow. When is that scheduled to run?
I never know when they're going to run them, but I'm assuming it's going to be this week since Clemson's playing Duke this week.
Okay. Fantastic. Really looking forward to reading that. Want to get away from the professional and to the personal, Ron. You were interested in publicizing some of your recent health issues, and I've been in touch with you for the last couple of months off and on. Can you just maybe give people an idea of what you've been going through lately?
Yeah, I'm kind of trying to spread the word about what's happened to me, because if I can help someone else avoid what I've been through, then I'm more than happy to tell the story. I had back surgery on October 5th, and after 4 months of severe back pain that entailed taking 10 to 12 painkillers a day. And the back surgery went really well. I have no pain in my back or any part of my body anymore. But I, in taking the painkillers, I developed an opioid addiction. So I'm basically a drug addict now. And it's going to be a long process to wean me of these drugs. But I'm hoping that in telling my story, I can relay to people that I might be the perfect example of it can happen to anybody. I haven't abused drugs in my life. And I'm not an alcoholic. I don't really have any addictions, maybe to sugar. But I now have a drug addiction, and the doctor in charge of my rehab essentially monitors the amounts of drugs that I take every day, and I reduce the amount every week in hopes that in 5 to 6 months I'll be able to free myself of this addiction.
And so you were scheduled to come up to Clemson on Tuesday for Dabo's press conference, but you had a bit of a setback that put you back on a longer timetable. I hate to sound ignorant, but maybe you can clarify.
Sure. That. Sure. I got to the point where, in the schedule, I was, moving pretty fast on it and doing pretty well for the first, month or so. And then I realized that I was going too fast because my body wasn't, it was still reacting to not taking enough of the medicine. So they basically stopped my program and moved me all the way back to the start. And now we're starting over again and extending the length of which I wean myself off the drugs. And so it'll be, instead of it being maybe a 3 month process, it's probably going to be 5 or 6 months. But I'm ready for that. I'm ready for the challenge. And I know I'm going to kick this thing. It's just going to take a lot more time than I thought.
Again, pardon my ignorance. Initially, after your back surgery, was it OxyContin that you were prescribed?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I was essentially taking, those OxyContin medications as painkillers. So it wasn't the surgery or after the surgery. It was before the surgery that I became addicted to drugs.
At what point did you realize you were addicted?
Well, the first day after surgery, I wasn't allowed to take any drugs in as part of the post-op. And that day was the worst day of my life. My body was shaking uncontrollably. I got into a fetal position. I was extremely cold. It didn't matter how many blankets I put on top of me. I was still freezing. I basically cried myself to sleep that day and night. And that's when I knew there was something wrong, that my body wasn't functioning properly without the drugs.
Okay, and then you got more.
Well, then I went back to, they said to go back to how many I was taking before and to start weaning myself every few days to reduce the amount of one of the drugs, of the three drugs, every 3 days. And then we realized, that's when we realized about a month or so into it, that that was too fast. I need to go back to the start and basically wean myself slower from these drugs. If okay. That makes sense.
Yep. All right. I'm going to sound like an idiot here probably, but my surface level understanding of OxyContin and opioids based on documentaries and reading and such is that it was hailed, I guess, in the 90s as this wonderful breakthrough because it wasn't as addictive, but people... when you have a lot of them, of the pills, people started taking more and more of them on their own, and then they get hooked. And then when they can't get any more OxyContin or painkillers, then that's when they move to heroin and more street-type access drugs. Is that...
Yeah, I don't know about all that. I only know about my instance, and... what I've been told by the doctors that I've been dealing with, and it's that each individual, just like with pain, each individual has a tolerance level for pain, and they also have a different tolerance level or not for the drugs to counter that pain. And so it's kind of a crapshoot on how much you should take or not take, mm-hmm. depending on who you are and what your body's like. And so it happened to be that my body couldn't take that much medication. It seemed like it was helping me, and it was helping me through the pain, but long term it was hurting my, it was basically crushing my immune system to drugs. And, but I don't know about beyond the actual opioid addiction and what could happen next. I'm not real familiar with all that.
Is there anything more? I hate, there's a terrible transition back to the professional and sports, but anything more you'd like to share on this topic and trying to sort of raise awareness?
No, just that. If you're in pain and you're taking painkillers, consult with your doctor as often as possible about the possibility of any side effects or long-term damage. If I'd have been a little smarter with it, I probably would have, not taken four painkillers at a time, in the morning and then again at night, and maybe just spaced it out a little bit but I wasn't knowledgeable enough about it. And I didn't know enough to ask questions about it. I just was taking the pills because they would kill the pain. And you just have to be careful and really talk to your doctors a lot. I mean, you have to bug the heck out of your doctors to make sure what you're doing is right and it's not going to have a long-term effect. And that's how, as I understand it, that's how most opioid addictions occur. And, if we can prevent people from getting into that situation, again, I'm more than happy to tell my story about it.
Man, it really seems like average people don't comprehend the strain that this is putting on our country. I mean, all these smaller communities torn apart, the hospitals are full of people who are dealing with it. It's almost like another war, I guess, economically.
It's an epidemic. It absolutely is an epidemic. And, I'll tell you one story, Larry. When I tell people about it initially, either by phone or in person, their initial reaction, I can tell on the phone and I can also see it when I tell people, their initial reaction is, wow, how'd you let that happen?
Yeah.
And it's not anyone's fault. It's just a lack of education on it. I understand perfectly when somebody thinks that I'm weak and allowed this to happen. I understand that thinking, but I also can tell them that it's not a sign of weakness. It's just, it can happen to anybody. And it happened to me, but I'm going to kick it. And I, you know, I hope the people who also have the same thing, are strong enough to kick it also and have good enough support to kick it.
Are you semi-retired? Is that what you would classify your job?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I'm working as much probably now as I did when I was employed in the state, but yeah, I think semi-retired is the right word. Yeah.
Just curious, hypothetically, if you were going through this while a full-time employee at a newspaper, wherever, do you think you would have been able to keep your job?
I think so, because I've been able to work right through it. But it's, I think there would have been some things like this past week. I had planned to go to Clemson for the press conference, and you know, it would have happened more frequently, where I would have had assignments that I couldn't attend, and that would have made it difficult. But I trust that any employer understands the problem and wants to work with their employees to accommodate their rehab, essentially, and help them through it. I can function pretty well most days. I just have to be aware of when it's time to take pills, and my body tells me when it's time to take them and how many to take. But I can work and function pretty well most days.
Ron, when did you leave the state?
Oh, gosh, it's been about 3.5 years ago now. Yeah, 3.5 years ago.
And if you don't mind, what were the circumstances behind your departure?
Yeah, there was a whole group of us at the state in the newsroom who were offered buyouts. And I think there ended up being in our group that left that day, I'm guessing here, but maybe 15 to 20 people took buyouts in the newsroom, which is a big chunk in the newsroom. And I can't speak for all of them, but I've talked to enough of them to know that they felt like I did. This was our last chance to get a buyout, because from then on, we kind of speculated that they weren't going to get buyouts anymore. They were just going to tell you were done. And so I got a nice little buyout to leave, and as did the others that day. And we were really smart in leaving at that time. That's kind of the way it worked. And it was time to get out for me, and also for the business. It's not the sports writing, the journalism business is not today like it was with what I grew up with and what I worked in.
Yeah, you look around the state of South Carolina at the lack of voices, columnist voices at the newspapers. There's Gene Sapikoff with the Post and Courier.
Mm-hmm. Is that it?
I can't think of any. I mean, I think Manny Robinson in Greenville writes some columns.
He does, yeah. He's really, both of them are really good, too.
But, man, you just look back 20 years ago. You had Ken Berger and Gene Sapikoff at the Post and Courier. You had Bart Wright, the Greenville News. You had you at the state. Bob Speer, I guess, was writing some columns then.
And Bob Gillespie also.
Bob Gillespie. What has been the casualty, in your opinion, of those voices basically disappearing?
Well, I think it's just shifted more to internet sites and fan sites. And so you don't have newspapers are dead, if not on their deathbed. And so people aren't looking to newspapers for commentary or even coverage anymore. They're going to fan sites and other websites, to get their information. And that's just the way the world is. You know, we can condemn it all we want, but that's where we are in 2018, and it's not all bad. You know, there are plenty of really good voices covering Clemson football, like you. and others, and there are plenty of good voices covering South Carolina football and athletics. It doesn't have to be, and it isn't, the sole place you went to get commentary before. It's not any different than the TV networks. It used to be you went to ABC, NBC, and CBS for your news, and now you go to any number of networks for your news and for your commentary. And that's not all bad to have more voices.
I've talked about this with other podcast guests, and my listeners are probably getting tired of it. I probably sound like a broken record, but this is definitely something I want your opinion on. My position, not saying it's the right position, but it's just my opinion, is that had newspapers been listening to the wishes and the desires of fans in the 90s and early 2000s, there wouldn't be a TigerIllustrated.com in that. I mean, I know you remember, and I remember. I used to say the same things. Fans wanted recruiting coverage. Come on, we're not going to cover that. You know, fans want more than one story a day on their team. We're not going to do that. Fans want to have a place where they can congregate with other fans and have conversations, as in message boards. Well, that's just beneath us. What is your opinion on that whole sort of evolution of media outlets sort of acknowledging fans' desires, and then now here we are in 2018, and you basically newspapers are doing what they should have done the whole time, but probably too late. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Oh, it makes perfect sense. I think it was the great Molly Ivins, who was a longtime political columnist for the in Texas. I'm not sure which paper she worked for, who said newspapers are dying a slow death, and it's all self-inflicted wounds.
Uh-huh.
And she hit it right on the head. I can remember those same meetings where we would say, well, people just aren't that interested. The general population is not that interested in high school sports. And to which I always argued, wait a minute, there are thousands of people who are participating in high school sports, and every one of those kids has one or two parents and maybe grandparents and brothers and sisters and cousins who are all interested in reading about that kid. So that seems like a natural audience for us. We should put more money into that. And the same thing with recruiting. I was one of those who said, because I didn't like recruiting, I said, well, nobody's interested in that. And it was stupid on my part. It was really short-sighted on my part, because people are interested in recruiting. However, you know, speculative and non-news value recruiting offers, people are interested in it. And you're right. You're exactly right. Had newspapers recognized all that, had they had some foresight back in the early 2000s, I'm with you. There might be fan sites today, but they wouldn't be to the same magnitude that newspapers would have offered.
Like the term news judgment, right? Like that's a really important part of working at a news outlet. You have to determine what's important, what's more important, what's less important. But there's a fine line between good news judgment and a newspaper saying, telling fans or readers, whatever, this is what you should be interested in, right?
Yeah, it really is. And we were so, we lived in a little vacuum or a shell and thought that profit margins would be at 30%, which is just outrageous for any company. But newspapers nationwide had a profit margin anywhere from 30 to 35%. And we really believed that was going to last forever. And we had no foresight to believe that maybe we should listen to our readers because they're telling us something different. And if we don't, our profit margins are going to nosedive, which they've done. And, but we didn't do that. We, we really believed, and I'm as guilty as anybody, we really believed that newspapers and their success would last forever, and instead newspapers went the way of railroads.
Or the milkman.
Or the milkman, yeah.
I remember I was at the Augusta Chronicle covering colleges, and the sports editor at the time brought me in for an interview. I want to say this was like 2002, somewhere around there, to cover high schools. And, you know, it's flattering. The state newspaper at the time was a big deal. And you were there, I guess, as an assistant sports editor?
That's correct, yeah.
And, okay, I already knew you at the time, but you pulled me into an office for a meeting for, I guess, your interview with me. And your interview with me consisted of, Larry, what in the hell are you doing? You got a great job. Don't take this job.
I don't remember that, but that was pretty smart on my part.
Anyway, it was good advice. When did you get to the state, and where did you come from when you went there?
Yeah, I started out working in the, I went to UNC Charlotte and started working in the Durham area for the Durham Morning Herald and Sun. And then I went to the Tallahassee Democrat in Florida for 10 years. And then they were owned by Knight Ridder at the time. And I kind of got moved. Essentially, it was not exactly that way, but I landed the job in Columbia from Tallahassee.
And what year was that, if you recall?
1999.
Yeah. Wow. So that's Lou Holtz's first year. Big times for them, you know, getting a coach of that stature. So, and then you became an actual columnist when?
2003, I believe it was. Yeah.
Okay. And what was that like, transitioning from more of an office administrative role to a voice of the community?
It was a difficult transition for me because I hadn't written in so long. I hadn't written since, my early days in Tallahassee. It was more of kind of knocking the rust off and learning to find good subject material and develop sources. And so it probably took me 2 or 3 years to get more into, I don't know if you want to call it a groove, but to get into where I felt more comfortable and confident in my abilities to write columns and also to have a voice. And I thought it was real important at the time to have a very strong voice, not just to write feature stories as columns, but to take a stand on issues. And if it meant tweaking the noses of people, as long as I talked to everybody on both sides and was fair in my reporting, I always felt pretty good about the writing of the column and taking a stand. I always lived by I wanted my columns to be far-reaching. And F-A-R, far, stood for fair, accurate, and responsible. And I tried my darndest to do that in my columnist career, and I still try and live by that standard today.
Business owners out there, if you own a business that accepts credit cards, you need to listen up. Tandem Payment, based right here in the upstate, run by Clemson folks, is changing the face of payment processing, quickly becoming the most cost-effective solution for all small businesses. Tandem's program saves you up to 90% on processing charges, and gives your customers what they love most, choices. This is not some crazy introductory offer. Tandem's technology allows business owners to offset their credit card processing costs by applying a small customer service charge to each sale they make. If you want to know more, visit TandemPayment.com today. Former Tiger Hot Rod McDowell works over there at Tandem Payment. They handle all their business and customer service face-to-face. So give them a call, 864-672-1570, if you're tired of spending an arm and a leg on all those credit card processing fees. So just, I guess, putting this in layman's terms, sort of an inside baseball type of thing is, so you have a beat writer, his job every day is going to cover the nuts and bolts of whatever team he's covering, lots of press conferences and such, practices. And so, therefore, it's pretty regimented, relatively speaking. Whereas a columnist, you're pretty much wide open in terms of subject matter, ideas, and all that. And you mentioned it took you a few years to develop your voice, to develop, I guess, the right story ideas. And can you provide a window into, just in layman's terms, how do you go about doing that? How do you go about networking, finding ideas, and sort of behind the scenes?
Yeah, the ideas, I've always thought there are writers and columnists who just have a gift for finding ideas, for looking at a situation and being able to analyze it and come up with an angle or an idea on it. And for whatever reason, I mean, if I had a strength as a columnist, it was my ideas. I've never been short of ideas, and I think it comes from reading. To me, the most important part of being a columnist is reading. And I read, I'm reading two books at a time, and I subscribe to five or six different magazines, not sports, the New Yorker, just because of the excellent writing and ideas. You never know when you're going to find an idea or an idea is going to pop into your head while you're reading something else. To me, that's the most important element of writing a column is ideas and reading to get those ideas. And I'm always struck by when I talk to other journalists and they don't read. I just find that kind of odd. But you have to develop your ideas, number one. And then the developing of contacts is if it's not equally important, it's the next step. And the way you do that is you talk to people. It's constantly just calling people just to say hello, and you begin to develop sources and connections. When I would go to a football game, most of us, I'm sure you do too, Larry, you arrive at least 2 hours before kickoff, maybe an hour and a half before kickoff. And to me, that was invaluable time spent in the press box, because you had athletic directors, assistant athletic directors, all these people were in the press box or in the area, and you could just go up there and just casually talk to them, and they get to know you, your face, and you could develop a communication vehicle there. And so that was a good way to develop sources. And then little things like one of my best sources, I can tell it now because he's deceased. One of my best sources at South Carolina was a former radio play-by-play announcer, Bob Fulton. And he and I became really good friends to the point where we took care of Bob a lot in the last couple of years of his life. And I'm almost hesitant to say this because I'm sure people at USC, if they hear this, will just cringe. But Bob would go down to South Carolina and visit the athletics department. He would talk to everybody there, and everybody would talk to him, and he would hear things.
And then he would tell you everything.
And then we'd go to lunch the next day, and he'd tell me everything he heard the previous day. It was just, and people had no idea that they were talking. They were just talking to Bob, but they were really talking to me.
sorry to interrupt. That's fantastic.
No, that's fine.
And that's an illustration of, over the years, there have been instances, of course, where, you have some information, whether it's the football program, basketball program, whatever, and the coach or whoever in the football, basketball office, whatever, is like, who told you that? Their first reaction is, who inside of my building told you that? And my answer has always been, look, this is not intramurals, okay? This town is obsessed with your football program. Thus, everybody is talking about your football program. So it doesn't necessarily have to go from someone in your football office to me, point A to point B. It could go from point A to, I could be point Z, but the point is I heard it and now I need to confirm it or, you know, yes. So anyway, that is fascinating. I don't think you've ever told me that.
Well, I'll tell you another one that when I was working in Durham, and Red Wilson was the head coach, Shirley Red Wilson, who was the king of the malprop, just a great guy. He just was always mangling his syntax and, all kinds of other things, but, he was the head coach at Duke. And I was the sports editor and writing columns also. And I had this incredible source within the team. It was the punter on the team who would just call me, you know, like after, if they did something different in practice, he'd call me. And, and one day Red Wilson pulled me aside and he said, I'm going to find out who your source is. And I said, oh, okay, good luck with that. He said, I can, you're learning things before I even know it.
Did he ever find out?
No, I never told. I guess I could say now it was a punter from Oxford, North Carolina named Ricky Brummett. And we had just developed sort of a casual friendship on the practice field. And he just started calling me with information. It was the greatest, knowing that a coach was so frustrated that he was gonna find that source.
Okay, so you mentioned the work that goes into building relationships, the importance of that, standing in the press box in the hours before a game, networking with athletic department folks. But you also, on the other hand, mentioned there are times when you need to tweak the people you cover in a fair and accurate and balanced fashion. What type of, I guess, delicate line do you have to walk when you're tweaking, but also risking ticking off the people that you're covering, not just the people you're writing about, but those athletics department folks? They work for the university and they aren't employed by the coach, but their livelihood is largely dependent on the big breadwinner, such as football at South Carolina. In that case, any anecdotes or recollections of maybe when that puts you at odds with some of the people you had developed really good relationships with?
Oh, it happened all the time at South Carolina. And what you do is if you're fair in your writing, you're accurate and you're responsible. That's a big thing. That's a big thing. The responsibility for what you write. So if I write something that's, you know, could be perceived as negative about Eric Hyman when he was the athletic director, I wanted to make sure that I talked to him beforehand and told him this is what I was writing. And so he knew about it beforehand. And also afterward, if it was Steve Spurrier afterward, I would sit front and center at the next press conference. So I was responsible for what I wrote. I'm right here if you have any problems with it. And that's so important. And I think, I don't want to throw a blanket over a lot of people, but it's missing a little bit in the fan sites because they're not being critical. And in my look at it, they're not being responsible. But I'll give you a good example, two of them, actually. There were many times that I wrote things at South Carolina that Eric Hyman did not like the stance I took. And the first call I would get the next morning would be from Eric Hyman saying, I really didn't like your stance on that. I'm not sure it was right. And I said, okay, well, let's talk it through. And that's what we would do. And there was a respect there that he knew what my job was and I knew what his job was. And there were going to be contradictions. There were going to be some headbutting, but professional people learn to work through those differences because you have a respect for the other person. But then there's the example of somebody who doesn't have respect for the media and the job they do. And that would be, in my case, it was Steve Spurrier. And I'll give you the best example. The one that really set him off against me was one line I mentioned in a column that I said that Spurrier poached Bruce Ellington from the men's basketball team. And for whatever reason, that drove him crazy. And it was a throwaway line. that if he had been smart, he would have just let it go. Instead, he made a big issue of it. He said, I made up the story. Well, the truth of the matter is, and I told him this, and he said he denied it to the hilt. The day after the Peach Bowl, the year that South Carolina lost to Florida State, I called him about something, and he told me that they needed to get Bruce Ellington to play football. And he said, I remember distinctly him asking me, have you ever seen Bruce Ellington play football? And I said, no, I haven't, but I understand he's really good. And he said, we need him on our football team. And then the coaching staff went about systematically trying to get him to play football and basketball. And really, there was nothing wrong with that other than Bruce Ellington was the showcase recruit. He was the face of the basketball program. And that was going to set Darren Horn's basketball program back years if he went over to football. And you would think that a responsible football coach would have talked to the basketball coach first before trying to get Ellington to switch over. But Spurrier didn't do that. Instead, he sent his assistant coaches out to talk to his high school coach and get him to persuade Bruce to switch over. Some of his assistant coaches were calling Bruce Ellington in the men's basketball locker room after games to talk to him about playing football. It was just a concerted effort to get him to switch sports, which, you know, in reality is not that big a deal. It's okay. But Spurrier seemed to think that was it was really degrading to him in some way. And my sources were an assistant basketball coach who was witnessing all of it, an assistant football coach who was telling me you were right, and Steve Spurrier. I mean, what better sources can you have than that? And everybody knew it was happening. But Spurrier denied it to a hilt and even brought Ellington to a press conference one day and pointed at me and said, Bruce is going to tell you exactly what happened in this. And Bruce sat there and said, yeah, I decided on my own to make that change. Well, you know, that was hardly evidence that it didn't happen, that there wasn't an effort to move him over, which, again, I was okay with it. I didn't think that big a deal. I didn't think it was that big a deal until he made it a big deal.
Ron, Spurrier was right. What you wrote was inaccurate. Steve Spurrier did not poach Bruce Ellington. His assistants poached Bruce Ellington.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Well, and that's the crazy, and I remember this at the time. I'm like, why wouldn't Spurrier just say, yeah, we're trying to get Bruce Ellington to play football because he's a great freaking football player, as he proved to be and still is.
That's all he had to say. That's all he had to say. But I think he realized that he really had undermined Horn's program. And I think that was his way of getting around his failings there, was to blame it on me and my fake news. but you know, that was only one of the many times when Spurrier and I clashed, and almost every time it came down to a lack of respect on his part for the job I did.
Okay, let's go back. You and Spurrier had a relationship that went way back because you covered him when you worked for the Durham paper, correct? When he was at Duke.
That's correct.
Okay, what were those days like? How many years did you cover him when he was at Duke?
Well, he was an assistant coach, I think, when I was there 1 year, and then I came back as the head coach 3 years, 87 through 89, and did an incredible job at Duke. He was a different kind of person then. You could walk onto the practice field during practice and stand and talk to him while he was conducting practice, and he welcomed it. And I don't think there was any real, there wasn't an us against them mentality with him at that time. And then even at Florida, when he was in Gainesville, I was in Tallahassee, and we kept in contact some. I wrote a couple columns about him and really no issues that I knew of. There was one minor issue when I was at Durham. He confronted me in a hotel in Atlanta when they were playing Georgia Tech. Duke was playing Georgia Tech. And he claimed that I misquoted him in a story. And he kind of, he was pretty adamant that I misquoted him or misconstrued what he said. And I told him that I had the, I happened to have the tape of it up in my hotel room. I'd be happy to bring it down and play it for him. But he didn't want to hear that. But that was, I don't think that ever led to anything else. I think it was over and done with. And then, so we had a really, really good working relationship, all the way up until, and even into his early days at South Carolina. But by then he had, I think he had become really bitter at, I'm not sure at what exactly, but I think he began to realize that he wasn't going to win championships at South Carolina. And so he really was starting to fail somewhat. And that's when he really turned on people. I wasn't alone, but I just happened to be the central figure that he turned on. And he became an ornery old man. I hate to say it about him, but that's exactly what he became. Just an ornery old cuss who couldn't accept criticism of any kind. And I hate that for him.
You said he turned on others. Who are you talking about?
Well, it wasn't so much in Columbia, but he had been turning on media in Columbia and in late in his years in Gainesville. After our little dispute went national, the reporter, I can't remember her name, for the St. Pete Times at the time, she wrote a story about all of his conflicts with the media over the years, and he had basically done the same thing to 9 others that he had done to me. And so this wasn't anything new. This was kind of his MO. If you were critical or disagreed with him, he would attack you in the media and make it public. Now this was, mine happened to come in the age of social media, so it became more of a news story, more of a recognized nationally that he was just out of line and ornery. He was angry at me and the media. And had the social media been around 10 years earlier, it would have been somebody in St. Pete. There was a columnist in St. Pete, I can't remember his name, who he went after him in the same manner he went after me.
Okay, so Spurrier's first year is 05, 06, 07. Things are good between you and Spurrier, correct?
Yeah, I think okay. All the way up. Yeah, keep going. Yeah.
Up to 10. All right, so I have to mention, 08, late November 08, Dabo's the interim coach trying to get the job for good. South Carolina comes up to Clemson in kind of a toss-up. I think quite a few folks think the Gamecocks are going to win. South Carolina had a pretty good team, I think.
Yeah.
Clemson proceeds to blow their doors off, thereby assuring Dabo the job, which he officially got 2 days later. But at that post-game press conference with Spurrier, an exchange that Clemson fans remember to this day, and in fact, Clemson fans have pleaded with me to ask you about.
Yeah. I'll give you a tip. There's somebody in the Clemson SID office who still says this to me every time he sees me.
All right, so Garcia, what was it? Was he hurt? Was he sick? Did he have the flu, Stephen Garcia? He didn't play.
Who knows? Could have been a suspension. I don't remember all of his transitions and transactions.
So anyway, South Carolina just falls apart. This was Spurrier's fourth season, and he had only beaten Clemson one time in 06.
Right.
And so it was looking like more of the same, an extension of the domination that Tommy Bowden had over South Carolina. And I guess they were going to like the Papa John's Bowl. Oh, no. Maybe that was the year they played Iowa in the Outback Bowl and got crushed. But anyway, I think after the press conference ended is when you like sort of persisted and maybe a follow up like, hey, Steve, like what where does this put your program? Like, where do you go from here? I think that was what you said, correct?
Yeah,
something like
I don't remember
anyway.
Exactly, but it was something about what, you know, you continue to lose to inferior Clemson teams. What's going on here?
And then the immortal words, "What do you want me to do, Ron?" How many times have you seen and heard that clip, either on video, audio, or as you said, from people who continue to recite it to you?
Oh, I don't remember ever going back and looking at it on video or audio or listening to it. But I hear it. Not so much anymore, but from then on at the state, I would hear it from Clemson fans all the time. It got to be pretty comical.
All right. So a year later, Clemson travels to South Carolina. They have sealed the Atlantic Division for the first time under Dabo Swinney in his first full season. I got the distinct impression, and you can tell me what you think of this, whether this is bull or not, that had Clemson won that game in Columbia with C.J. Spiller, that Spurrier either might have hung it up or South Carolina's administration might have tried to sort of nudge him out and say, you know what, it's time for us to try something new. Is that bogus?
Yeah, I don't know about that. I never sensed that. I only sensed it from the fans were fed up with him. And, you know, they can talk all they want about how they want Muschamp gone. It was nowhere near the level of the noise about Spurrier about that time.
Really?
I think, yeah. What had he done to that point? He came in and he promised them they were going to be he borrowed the Red Sox slogan, "Why not us?" So we were going to win SEC championships. He took down all of the orange beat Clemson stuff in the locker rooms and in the athletic department, said all that needed to go. The Clemson rivalry was not that important. What was important was winning the SEC. And by then it was becoming pretty clear, they might win an SEC division some point, but they're not going to win an SEC championship. It isn't going to happen. And the fans were ready for him to go. I just don't think, I think it was Hyman was the AD then, right?
I believe so.
Yes, I think he was. And I had a really good relationship with him as far as him giving me a good feel for things. I'll tell you another story along that lines if you're interested, but, he would kind of tip me off if Spurrier was, they were getting ready to get rid of him. I never heard that from anybody. I think they realized they had a coach that they never before could have gotten. Even Lou Holtz wasn't as big as Spurrier. And if anybody could do it, it was Spurrier. If anybody could turn it around, it was him, and the administration was going to hang on to him. But I'll tell you the other story about being tipped off, if you're interested.
Yes.
Darren Horn was in his last season as the basketball coach, and I attended an NCAA women's tournament press conference at the Colonial Life Arena, and I came up to, I ran into Hyman and I pulled him out in the hallway and said, "Look, I'm writing this column tomorrow in support of Darren." And he said, "Oh no, you are?" I said, "Yeah, why?" And he said, "I'll tell you what, I will tip you off on a story that's coming up if you don't write that column." And I said, "I think I know where this is going." I called the office and had him kill the column. Now that's the way a relationship should work with an athletic director.
Okay, and then what? Was he fired?
And then he was fired a couple weeks later. And Eric held to his word. He called me up to tell me that it was happening.
Wow. That's amazing. Okay, so the 2009 game against Clemson, I go into that game thinking, okay, yeah, Clemson's going to win again. They're too good. They have too many playmakers, blah, blah, blah. And of course they have South Carolina's number over the last decade, let alone century. But I was on the field during pregame at midfield. We'll never forget it. I'm watching Clemson go through warmups. And then I turn around and I'm looking at South Carolina going through warmups. And almost stopped in my tracks at how big they looked. You see Alshon Jeffrey running around. You see a different stature team than you're used to seeing at South Carolina. And I'm like, wow, this is a good-looking team. I mean, you got some NFL-looking dudes here.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't strike me at the time, oh, South Carolina's going to win this game. It only made total sense in hindsight what was brewing there, the kind of guys they were recruiting, the bigger, more physical, I hate to say, SEC-type athletes, but it was true. Like, they were quietly building that type of kind of monster, correct? Did you sense it at the time?
I didn't sense it at that time, but then what happened was, and it's easy to see it now, was Clemson was going through a coaching transition, right? Around that time. North Carolina was going through a transition. Duke was going through a transition. All the schools in the area were all going through coaching changes and program changes. And at the same time, whatever you want to call it, a cosmic conversion, South Carolina was producing a greater number of NFL type players than any time in the state's history. I mean, they were coming out of the woodwork, and South Carolina was taking advantage of these transitions and Steve Spurrier's name. At that time, he was still known to kids as this great coach. And it all fell together. They started getting all those kids instead of Clemson, instead of North Carolina. They were pulling kids out of North Carolina. And it all just kind of fell together perfectly. And all the credit for that goes to Steve Spurrier and his recruiting and his taking advantage of the situation. Don't you think?
Yeah. And less than a year later, South Carolina was whipping Alabama. Nick Saban's Alabama in Columbia. So, yeah.
And they won the SEC East.
Yep. Okay, we're going to stop there and break this into two segments. The second will come on Monday morning. Wow, that was really impressive of Ron to have the courage to share his personal story with the hope that he can be of some help to others in the world who might be confronted with the same types of demons, I guess you could say. And it, like he said, it can happen to anybody. So it's a chilling personal account that really sort of makes the hair stand up on your neck, honestly. So thank you to Ron for sharing his time and his story with us. Thank you to title sponsor Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in downtown Greenville. Also, the Abernathy Boutique Hotel in Clemson. And finally, last but not least, Tandem Payment in Greenville. Everybody have a great weekend. Enjoy the game. Enjoy senior night. And stay tuned for part two of Ron Morris, scheduled to be published on Monday morning. Cheers.